John, great to see you. How are you, buddy?
Good. I started off the start of the show just as a very non-political observation about how the DNC was run, shouting out the Chicago Police Department for an excellent job. I imagine you'd echo that amongst all city workers, yeah?
I think CP did an amazing job. I thought, like, the worry coming into the convention was that Chicago or crime or the protesters were going to be the story, and I felt like they weren't. And nope. I think CP did just an amazing job. Such a professional approach to it and such a great strategy. And I think everyone came away from this thinking, wow, Chicago really shined.
That's a tough job. I was watching some social media posts of just some very light, I don't even want to call them skirmishes. People were trying to blow it up, like, look at how the chaos in Chicago is. And if you zoomed out, it was a couple protesters doing things they shouldn't be doing. The things that they say to police officers to their face for hours while they're just staring there, police do. They have a lot more self-restraint than I would have, I'll say that.
Yeah, it's kind of like a ball player. You just got to stand there and just like literally just pretend it's not happening. And
yeah.
I guess at some point maybe you learn to just let it, you know, you're not even hearing it, but yeah. I'm sure occasionally you do, and I'm sure it really eats you up inside.
Having said that, of course, the protesters have their rights, and I think that they were allowed where they needed to be and making the points that they wanted to make, and that's the beautiful thing of this country, and I'm glad it didn't escalate any further. So
yeah, and the arrests, you know, the arrests weren't very high, which was great.
Did you hear me at the top of the show? I compare it was 76 total compared to 668 in 1968.
Wow. Plus, I mean, I don't think there's been any allegations of abuse in connection with the arrest, which is great as well.
Yeah, I think maybe it was Don Kleppen said that there were six cases that went to COPA or eight that are currently being investigated, but nothing for anything too extraordinary. So
yeah, and the good thing about all those cases, they're going to be extremely well documented.
Yes. You know,
both by from the police side, from the pod camera side, from the protester side. So you're going to have a very clear sense of what happened.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Mike, you got any questions for me? I know you like to start the show with that.
Well, John, I'm feeling a little bit like a wrestler today.
Wrestler like off the top ring jumping down, or like a wrestler who's on the mat?
An old school wrestler on the mat, because if you remember, back in December of 2023, we had myself and Patrick Dolan on the show. Mm-hmm. And we kind of went head-to-head in the prosecution and defense of the Grinch.
That's right.
And I feel like Patrick's been docking me ever since. You know,
oh,
so
yeah.
I'm putting out, just like an old school wrestler would put out a challenge for him to appear on the show with me. Patrick Dolan, if you're listening or your people are listening, we want you back on the show.
Okay, together as one. You're referencing when you successfully defended the Grinch and he was found not guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to lord my victories over anybody. I'd be the last, of course, to talk about myself, John. But I certainly did, you know, teach Mr. Dolan a lesson that day.
Are we going to do that again this year?
Yes, absolutely.
Or maybe we should find out.
Might need a new case.
Well, maybe we can do Kevin McAllister's parents.
Yeah.
To see if they should be found guilty for child neglect for leaving their kid at home.
I think that'd be good. I mean, I think we need to mix it up. The audience probably might be getting tired of the Grinch. I don't know.
Right. Ridian was suggesting we do maybe Halloween something theme. Maybe the Nightmare Before Christmas, a trial on something along those lines. I don't know.
Sure, John. I'm ready to defend all comers, so just let me know.
Okay, cool. And anything rocking in your world? I know you're having what is going to be, it's probably pretty rare for someone in your role. You're having a vacation here soon.
Yeah, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary, so we're getting away for a little bit. We planned it for about literally a year, so it kind of suddenly feels like it's going to be real. We'll be taking off Friday and, you know, putting everything aside for a little bit.
How hard is that for a lawyer to unplug and take it away? Because I mean, you're navigating the world of scheduling trials, and is there like a season that there are trials that don't happen at that time, or do you just have to kind of get lucky and ask judges to move things around?
Well, you got to think way in advance. So since we planned this trip about 9 months ago, I mean, we were basically for the last 9 months trying to avoid any scheduling, you know, of motions and hearings during these 2 weeks coming up, but you can't totally avoid it. But also I work with others, so,
true,
you know, we'll be well covered.
All right, very good. Audrey and I were talking. She does so much great work as a juvenile defense attorney. She does adults too, but she really has built a practice that helps out with kids. And thank goodness, because nowadays kids are, some might say rightfully so, some may not. There's so much scrutiny about what kids do, where they go, what they're doing on their phones. And we were having a good conversation about it with back to school happening and kids having pictures on their phones that they shouldn't have. And, you know, this is a tough conversation to have, Mike, because obviously no one wants kids to have pictures they shouldn't have on their phone, but living in the real world, these things happen. And you kind of wanted to talk a little bit about how this world blends in the federal atmosphere, because this happens, right?
Yeah, it does. There are federal prosecutions for the types of cases Audrey was talking about. And yeah, it's an uncomfortable subject for everybody, because especially if you have kids and, you know, you're worried about what they're looking at, what they're exposed to, what could possibly be on their phones, all those sort of issues. But in the federal context, and we just tried one of these cases last year, the way it comes up typically is, you know, there's one juvenile in one state and somebody who's 18 or above in another state, because part of the prosecution element and theory and proof that they have to meet beyond reasonable doubt is that it involves interstate commerce or an instrument of interstate commerce. So, you know, any use of the internet, social media, phone, that satisfies that element. So that's when they typically would get involved. And so, yeah, we had a real intense case last year, someone who was above 18 who were defending, and the victim below 18. And it's a very tough case to defend because essentially there is no, of course, consent is not an issue. If you're underage, consent is assumed it's not given as a matter of law. You can't Yeah, of course. And you can't also raise the issue that, you know, you didn't know they're that age. Again, that's not a defense at all. So you really have
Wait, really? You can't say? What if someone lies to you?
Unfortunately.
Not a defense.
It's basically like strict liability. So you have to rely upon, you know, the elements that the government has the burden on. And sometimes you're really defending on a very narrow window, right, in terms of trying to argue that your client did not entice or induce the other person to send something of a sexual nature, you know, that they did it voluntarily or did it without you inducing or enticing them to do so. So they're very tough cases. Of course, from a jury's perspective, they're very tough cases to get not guilty verdicts because everyone's keenly attuned to these types of sexual issues. So
right.
You really, you have a difficult time trying those cases, and oftentimes they're not tried in federal court. Oftentimes they result in pleas.
Yeah. And again, it's an uncomfortable conversation to have. Everyone's due to that defense. And yeah, I think a lot of people probably don't understand the laws as it pertains to that. You think, oh, that person lied about their age, I'm covered. No, you're not. I mean, it really just brings up a broader angle of just no one should be really engaging in any of this activity or just absolutely know exactly what is happening in these sorts of scenarios.
Yeah, we're not defending the activity, of course. And, you know, the problem is, you know, just really sending anything of a sexual nature through a transmission such as a text, any vehicle of social media, definitely exposes you potentially to criminal prosecution on either side. You know, you could be a minor and you could get charged. You could be the person above 18. You could get charged. You could be in a relationship that both parents know about and approve of. You could get charged. So you have to be extraordinarily careful and mindful of the fact there are these laws both at the state and federal level that really can have significant consequences, not only in terms of prison time, but also just your future as labeled a sex offender and all the collateral consequences that go with that type of prosecution.
And I imagine it gets a little squirrely too at universities where people think that, you know, I mean, obviously they're adults, they're over the age of 18 for the most part at universities, but a lot of young adults at that age don't act like they are adults. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. So that's been, you know, I think a couple weeks ago we were talking about student, university, and college disciplinary cases. If you remember that, John, about 2-3 weeks ago. And I think our focus that day was on the AI cases.
All right.
Which we've been defending a number of those because we won't go way back into the topic. But university and colleges now routinely use AI detectors or so-called detectors and then bring student disciplinary actions against students. But one of the other huge areas and growth areas in terms of us defending university and college students is in these sexual misconduct cases. So I'll give you an example. We had one against a major university where the parties had what seemed to be, by everyone's account, a consensual relationship. They're both above 18, you know, spent a lot of time together, socialized with friends, all the stuff you would be the hallmark of a college relationship. And there was a sexual component to that. And then they broke up. And then about, you know, 3 to 6 months later, one of the parties made the allegation that, gee, it really wasn't consensual on certain occasions because I was intoxicated and therefore I couldn't give consent. And that, you know, then spurred a whole university investigation, a disciplinary proceeding against a student, and all that goes with that. And, you know, the stakes are high. Because if you're the student and you lose, you're likely to get expelled. That's not the only punishment, but you could be certainly expelled, and that's likely in that type of case. But all the things that go with it, all the other collateral consequences, you know, that on your resume, on your transcript, it's going to show you were expelled from the university. It's going to hurt your job prospects. It certainly put in jeopardy that student's externship prospects. And so there's a whole series of procedures that go to those cases, and it really is like a criminal case. However, at the university level, all the safeguards you usually see in a criminal case are really not there.
Like proof beyond a reasonable doubt, stuff like
Correct.
That.
Correct. So, you know, what you basically have is the university assigns an investigator. They might be skilled. They might be horribly unskilled. They might be very inexperienced, have little experience in doing these types of investigations. And, you know, they don't have a lot of power. They can request documents from, you know, the people who have knowledge. The attorney can give them people to contact, but the attorney can't do that job. The attorney, though, can be attempt to be more aggressive in the prospect by doing their own sort of parallel investigation, by getting witness statements, getting people to give sworn statements, things of that nature, and then provide them to the investigator. But then the investigator just basically takes this information, and then you have what I would say is very much a kangaroo court hearing where the student doesn't really have legal representation. They're allowed to have a representative. It could be an attorney, could not be an attorney. But that person's not allowed to cross-examine any witnesses or is usually able to speak. Can you imagine that? You know, you're basically, it's really the equivalent, if you think about it, of a criminal trial.
Mm-hmm.
But your attorney is not allowed to confront and cross-examine the witnesses, certainly not the victim. And really, your role is limited to giving questions to your client that he can pose to the witnesses or to the panel. So it's a procedure that really lacks a lot of the hallmarks of due process with incredible consequences for your client.
Yeah. We should also pause just for a moment and make sure that listeners, I think, understand also. I am glad we live in a world now where when a victim speaks up, we listen, and we should.
Oh, no doubt.
I mean, I think that obviously you're a defense attorney, and so we have a lot of conversations about defending people, even if they do wrong things, deserving that defense. But in our conversation about an underage person being lured to share photographs, completely inappropriate and should be prosecuted. I mean, like, I just want to make sure we lay this foundation to the conversation, too.
Oh, yeah. Look, at the university level, one of the great advances we've had, and we're still not there, is that people do feel much more empowered and have the resources and the avenues and mechanisms to do it, to come forward with allegations, which in the past would never even be considered. They'd be sort of swept under the rug, or the victim would not be emboldened enough to come forward. So that's been a huge advance. And then we got to get there on a holistic level, right? Right. So we've encouraged victims to come forward, which is fantastic. And now we just got to make sure that the procedures we employ, you know, are fair to everybody.
Right. Yeah. I just don't want people to think that we are trying to make people feel bad for people that are committing crimes. That's not at all the conversation we're having.
No, I'm just talking about, really, it's more of an interesting topic because, you know, our practice is not just in the court. Sometimes it's just before these university disciplinary panels, which has been sort of a burgeoning practice because there's more and more of those cases.
Okay. 312-981-7200. If you have any questions, let's take a break. More with Mike Leonard after this. Kind of curious what cases you're working on. Anything you can share about interesting procedures or what you got going on?
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes when you're not on trial, you're really spending a lot of time writing, which is a big part of the job, you know, both pretrial and post-trial. So oftentimes we're called in after a case is tried, if it doesn't go the right way, to then handle the appeal for that defendant. And so it involves really two stages in federal court, you know, what's called the post-trial motions and then the appeal. So the post-trial motions, you're basically attempting to convince the court that they made a legal error, essentially, that
the judges that did it themselves.
Yeah, which is tough, and we'll talk therefore about the odds, right?
Uh-huh.
But let's first talk about the procedure. So you're trying to convince the court, and you know the difficult part you're in is if you didn't try the case, and you're coming in a post-trial motions, you don't have that intimate familiarity. You know, you read the trial transcripts, you read all the motions, but you haven't lived it, so you don't have sometimes the perspective on what issues were really crucial during the trial. You can see what was raised, but you're not there to argue them. You don't see how the judge reacted to them. But essentially, in a post-trial motion, you're trying to convince a federal court judge that they let in evidence they shouldn't have, that was prejudicial and that mattered to your client, that it contributed essentially to them losing the case, or vice versa, that they excluded evidence that was material and that it affected the outcome of the case and prejudiced your client. So essentially, you're trying to convince a court that they made a mistake at the post-trial motion stage. You can also, in some circumstances, argue that it could have nuanced, but that the evidence wasn't sufficient, that no reasonable jury could have found him guilty based upon just the case the prosecution put forward. So
Wait. You can argue, and I know that's probably not a high success rate, that the jury got it wrong, essentially?
Oh, of course. You can argue that in every case. Sometimes it works. Most times it doesn't. But what happens in any criminal trial, whether you're in state court or federal court, as you know, the prosecution goes first, puts on their case. They have a burden. And when they rest, you know, the defendant doesn't have any obligation to put on any case at all. But before the scene shifts to the defense case, you always file a motion, whether it's state court or federal court, arguing that the government has not met its burden, that they have not produced sufficient evidence that could sustain a conviction. In state court, you know, that motion might be granted. You know, it's still rare, but, you know, maybe 10%, 5% or less of the time. In federal court, I'd say your odds of winning that motion are about 1%. Mm-hmm. But you have to make that motion and you have to preserve those issues, right? And then the trial proceeds. Then you go to the defense case. And then if your client is found guilty, you still have that ability to file post-trial motions, which you, for the most part, you're focusing on errors that the judge made. And of course, it's difficult to persuade a judge that they got it wrong. And so then if the case proceeds to a sentencing hearing, then finally you can appeal the case and raise all the issues that you think were wrong in terms of pretrial rulings or rulings during the trial. And the reason for that is, of course, it would seem fair that you'd have a different group of people looking over the shoulder of the trial court judge and deciding if he or she got it right. And that's what you get. You get a three-judge panel who looks at the case brand new. They could decide in rare circumstances the evidence wasn't sufficient. That happens very rarely, as you just pointed out. But oftentimes, an appeals court does find that there was a legal error. And they can remand the case for a new trial, or they could reverse the conviction.
I get a procedural snafu that someone says this was handled improperly by the judge. I find it very strange, and it's probably why it is so rare. The idea being that, no, given the evidence that was presented, the jury should not have found this person guilty. That seems crazy to me, because the jury is the ultimate arbiter about what they determined to be, and if they followed the procedure of deliberating, going through it, and they found your client guilty, that's the ruling of the jury. You don't get to go after the fact and say, that couldn't possibly have been enough evidence.
Well, I think you should be, and here's why. It's really an important safeguard, because there are cases that are prosecuted where the evidence, and again, I'm not saying this happens all the time, is threadbare. It is not sufficient. If you go back to the 1960s, certainly in some rural areas,
well, you're about to slap me down,
certainly in
cases,
the South,
yeah.
Where a case was presented that had really no support, and the jury, for whatever reasons, it could be biased reasons, it could be prejudice reasons, it could be all sorts of reasons, and the judge, therefore, should be able to step in and say, no, hold on here, guys, that evidence is not sufficient, despite the fact that the jury made that finding, there is not sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. So I think it's a hugely important safeguard.
Fine, you're right. That was a good.
You don't have to roll over John. I want you to fight me on
these
things.
There's a lot of cases where you have, in the 1960s, 50s, before then, cases where the fix was in the moment the person walked in the room.
Yeah, and even if there's no fix.
Not even the fix, the prejudices were there.
No, but that's true. I mean, there were prejudice, and there was essentially, and you're right, there was kind of a fix. But now, there are cases where the evidence is light, it's insufficient, and it is an important role of the judge to evaluate and say, hey, look, I understand the jury system is important, but look, what they presented is not sufficient as a matter of law. And sometimes, in rare instances, the government fails on just one of the elements. So you've probably been on a jury, and they explain to the jury in jury instructions, hey, look, the government has the burden to prove these four elements. And mm-hmm. It might fail on one of them. And then it's the judge's job to say, hey, look, guys, you failed to produce sufficient evidence on that one element. The case goes away.
Sounds good. Post-trial things. You talked about the process between the verdict and the sentencing where you could maybe get things reversed. And you talked about a few scenarios in which that was unlikely to happen but possible. After the sentencing, you enter a new phase, right?
Yeah, then it's the appeal phase. So you can't appeal in state or federal court until you actually have a judgment, meaning your client has been sentenced, right? And so after they're sentenced, then you file a notice of appeal, and that kicks off this process by which you have to do a lot of procedural things first, but essentially it's a briefing process. So if you're the defendant who's appealing, you file the first brief and you try to raise the significant issues that you think give you a chance of getting either a new trial or getting it reversed entirely. You know, getting it reversed entirely is rare. We have done it once. Getting a new trial is also relatively rare. Depends what jurisdiction you're in. We've had that result too. But of course, what your client wants is another chance. You know, whether the case gets thrown out or whether they get back, that's, of course, that would be the optimum. But getting back to having another bite at the apple, of course, that's a fantastic opportunity.
So I just want to mention that in this appeals process, the burden which you had in the initial process as a defendant, which is beyond reasonable doubt, the sides have shifted here now in appeal, right?
Well, no. So basically what the appellate court's looking at, they're not reweighing the evidence. They're not reassessing credibility. They're not doing any of that. They're not sort of second-guessing the jury. What they're really doing is looking over the shoulder of the trial judge, deciding, you know, did the trial judge rule appropriately and correctly on all the pretrial motions? Did the judge rule appropriately with respect to all the legal issues raised during the trial? You know, sort of what we were talking about before. Did the trial judge make a mistake in letting things in or not letting things in? And, you know, in rare instances, they could find that there was insufficient evidence to support the verdict. In federal court, that happens very rarely. But, you know, there are issues raised such as constitutionality of statutes and things of that nature that you raised before the trial court that were denied, that then this court can take up.
So it's something that, so we got a lot of different things going on here. So I want to tackle these sort of like one at a time. Judges' mistakes, right? Does the appeal court have to determine that, yes, the judge made an error, but then do they have to take the next step and say, and that affected the outcome of the trial?
John, I don't know why you're not either in law school or a law school professor, because you get to stuff very quickly. And we didn't give you any cliff notes to start.
No.
But yeah, so they're looking at, that's the difficult thing for the defendant. So they can say, look, even if they agree with you on appeal that, hey, we agree it was legal error for the judge to admit or exclude this particular evidence, right? They still make the next step and say, did it matter? You know, did it affect the outcome of the case? Did it, you know, result in essentially substantial prejudice to your client? And sadly, very often they get to that second step and they say, ah, it doesn't matter anyways, because the evidence was so overwhelming in various other respects. So it's very disappointing to have that happen to you, and it happens on a regular basis.
Where you find out, oh yeah, you agree with us that they made a mistake, but you don't agree that it was consequential.
Yeah, and that's a tough one to swallow.
Okay, right before I cut you off, you had said something that made me go back. What was it? The fourth reason, or one of the reasons why they might grant an appeal as okay.
Oh, like why would they would overturn?
Excuse me, the constitutional issues. Okay,
yeah.
So these are issues you're saying you can win on appeal. This is something that before the trial even began, you said this evidence shouldn't have been allowed because maybe it was found illegally by the police, or there's some other constitutional issue here. This charge shouldn't even apply to this defendant. You lost that, and the trial was allowed to go on. You get a chance now to argue, hey, that ruling at the beginning of the trial should have been made a different way.
Absolutely. And that comes up in terms of constitutionality. It comes up a lot in the issue of search and seizure, which was heard by the trial court by way of a pretrial motion. And you're making the argument that it was unconstitutional. There's also instances where arguing that a federal statute, unconstitutional. Now, you might think, that would seem weird, Mike. Why would you be arguing that? It's been a big deal in federal court in Chicago on these federal gun cases. So you've had in the same building in Chicago, you've had different judges reach the exact different conclusion. So there's a law in federal court called felon in possession, meaning you can be federally charged because you're a felon, you have a history of a felony conviction, and you can't possess a firearm, right? So those cases are very commonly brought. A lot of times they're first charged as state court crimes, and then the feds take them and make them federal crimes instead. And so one of the huge issues for the last couple of years has been, is that statute constitutional? And the reason why there's so much talk about it is because the United States Supreme Court came down with a decision a couple of years ago and cast it all in doubt.
Yes.
So literally, if you can believe it, might seem unusual, but in our building in Chicago, you have a couple judges, really primarily one saying that is unconstitutional. Those people got released. The charges were dismissed. Other judges had very significant issues and problems, but still, you know, said that the case could go forward. And the Supreme Court has not yet definitively ruled on whether that particular statute's unconstitutional. People have been briefing this issue across the country, including us, waiting for a decision from their particular appellate court and ultimately from the United States Supreme Court. So these constitutional issues do come about. They're not just textbook things. You know, they're legitimate arguments in some cases.
I just want to rewind that for a second, because I believe you're referring, I don't know the case name off the top of my head, from the Supreme Court.
Bruin, yeah.
And this was now, and Clarence Thomas, I believe, wrote the majority opinion, and his argument essentially was, or maybe it was in the concurrence, that gun law has to go back in time to when the framers wrote the Constitution. You need to find equivalent restrictions on gun control in the 1790s for it to be enforceable now.
Yeah.
Right?
And which to me makes absolutely no sense. So yeah, the Supreme Court said, look, any of these gun laws, whether a local gun law, a state gun law, a federal gun law, to analyze whether it's constitutional today, you got to essentially go back in time and figure out what, at the time of the framers, was there essentially an analog? Was there an analogous statute that limited those rights in a certain way?
So, right. So if Massachusetts state court had outlawed you having a gun for X, Y, or Z back in 1790, you could make the argument that that was in mind of what the framers had done, and then that law could still remain in place.
Yeah, so think of how bizarre that is. So for the last couple of years across the country, federal criminal lawyers have been arguing, going back in history, trying to make arguments to the court as to what laws are reflective of the law of today, with, of course, the federal government prosecutors arguing that there's always a law back in time that supports what we're doing today, and defense lawyers arguing to the contrary. It is really a bizarre structure that the Supreme Court set up for these judges. And in some cases, the courts have actually appointed what's called an historian to go back and, you know, an expert to look at all the statutes, all the writings from that period of time, and try to come up with a suggested answer for the court. So I don't think it makes any sense. I think it's caused just chaos in terms of different judges around the country reaching different results about what history says about laws that are analogous to the laws of today. So it's really a bizarre state of affairs.
It's like, I understand where Clarence Thomas's original thought, as an originalist as he is, he's trying to say, well, let's try and, as best we can, deconstruct what framers were thinking based on the laws that existed at the time. I kind of get where he's going for with that. The problem is, though, and especially with gun laws, and this is not my critique to the Second Amendment as a whole or not, I'm not making that argument, but specifically to this Bruin case, the idea of someone, let's say you're in a domestic relationship that has gone terribly wrong, and you have a husband or a boyfriend who has threatened you with weapons, and you're the victim of terrible violence in that regard, should that person who inflicted that violence upon you be allowed to have a weapon? You would likely not find case law in the 1790s, because it would be insane for a woman to have said anything to anyone about that. They would have just kind of taken it on the chin, horrifically speaking. So there would literally have not been a reason to have a law about domestic abuse and domestic abusers allowed to have guns or not, because no one would have ever brought that up.
Yeah.
Is that probably the strongest argument against Bruin?
Yeah, fantastic argument. And that's one of the few cases after Bruin that U.S. Supreme Court has actually decided.
Yes.
They were confronted with that issue.
This year?
This year, a federal statute that related to, I think it was a federal or state statute, related to domestic violence and the ability to have someone to have a gun while they're under order protection. And they ruled on that. And then, interestingly enough, they understood the sort of chaos and doubt they had created by their first decision. And they tried to kind of go out of their way to say, hey, look, hold on here. We weren't saying in our decision a couple of years ago that, you know, every gun law is suspect and should be overturned. You know, they kind of attempted to reframe the analysis, but still, things are really in a state of flux in many respects.
I hope this made sense to people, because I know we got in a little of the weeds here. I just want to I guess the broader point that you're making is law is very complicated. And even after Supreme Court's issue rulings, trying to analyze exactly what the rulings mean. The tests that they set up for free speech, for instance. The Bruin ruling where they say you have to find these analogous... What's that word?
Analogous. They call them analogs.
There you go. You have to find similar case law. It is still left to the interpretation of prosecutors, judges at local levels to understand what the heck they're thinking. And we don't often get answers immediately, if ever, or for a generation, on what definitively they meant.
Yeah, and I think another thing people don't necessarily appreciate until they have to go through this system. I just had this come up with a client recently in a federal case where we're going to sentencing in a particular circuit, not in Illinois, not in the Seventh Circuit. And so a case came down from another circuit, which seemed to provide support for our position, but we're in a completely different circuit. And that decision was contrary to the circuit that we're in. So we're in the D.C. circuit, so they have their own Court of Appeals that handles certain states. And then we have Illinois as the Seventh Circuit, which handles Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana. And so one circuit court of appeal in the United States can find something to be unconstitutional, and another circuit where you have a case pending can say, no, it's completely constitutional. So it surprises people sometimes to hear that these circuits with these learned judges can have complete disagreements about what is right and wrong in terms of constitutionality, and the Supreme Court may never take the case up to decide who's right.
So defendants could be found guilty of certain crimes in some districts or in some circuits and not others, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, imagine that you're in one circuit and your circuit court of appeals finds that the statute or a portion of it is unconstitutional, right? And you have a defendant with the same charge, same type of alleged crime, in a different part of the country, another circuit, and their court says, nah, we think it's constitutional. And, you know, one guy's walking away and one guy's going to prison for a long period of time. And the Supreme Court, their job is to decide conflicts among the circuit, but they might not get around to that for years, or they may never address it at all because they don't think it's significant enough.
Best legal system in the world still?
It still is, John.
Okay, yeah. Let's take a break. More with Mike Leonard after this on Let's Get Legal on WGN. What percentage of cases do you score some sort of victory after a verdict is reached, typically?
If you look statistically at the granting of post-trial motions, very, very limited. If you look at the granting in terms of a reversal of a jury verdict in a criminal trial at the state or federal level, at the federal level, got to be like about 5% or less. The state level, you know, universally across the country, maybe it's 25%.
Okay.
Remanding for a new trial, obviously a higher percentage, but it's difficult. It's difficult to get it overturned because, like you argued earlier, there is a great deference given to the jury because they make credibility determinations. They weigh the evidence. And so the judges, even on appeal, don't redo that.
Right. I think that number of anywhere from 10 to 25%, depending on federal to state, sounds about right, right? Like, I feel like it should be hard. We don't want every conviction overturned, especially ones on technicalities or very slim things that didn't make a difference.
I knew you were going to say something. Come on.
But I think that that's enough to show that hopefully the appellate system takes a strong look at these things to not only reverse decisions that were bad, but to send a message to lower court judges and the system as a whole to take things as seriously as possible.
It works well. However, there are still, you know, glaring injustices. There's this case going on right now. I'll just digress a little bit because it's getting a lot of attention. It's in the state of Missouri. A guy was convicted of murder about 20 to 30 years ago. They finally had, because of the advances in DNA, really bedrock, solid proof. DNA establishes it couldn't be him. It wasn't him. And the big fight in the Missouri courts right now is just to allow the evidence to be heard by a court. You have the Missouri Attorney General intervening and saying, no, the trial court shouldn't even get to consider this, you know, which is incredibly significant evidence. So sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm, yeah, and that's the problem, is that you have politically elected officers making system decisions on judicial matters, but that's the system we got. Someone wanted to know on a basic level, but I appreciate these questions because I always want to make sure we're getting them. We talk about briefings. What does a briefing mean?
Yeah, briefing lawyers like to say, I'm working on a brief, or I drafted a brief. So it's just a written document setting forth your arguments. So on appeal, for example, when we say we file a brief, it's just a written, you know, written argument that lays forth the facts of the trial and sets forth the legal issues that we think provide a basis for the case to be reversed or to get a new trial. It's just a formal way of saying a written document, a persuasive written document that you're submitting in support of whatever motion or position you're arguing.
Okay. We got a minute left.
We got two important subjects.
Go.
Bears, what's your prediction?
10-7. How about
11
you?
11-6, baby. 11-6. Fantasy football, you in or out, John?
I'm never a fantasy footballer.
Oh, that's really sad.
You're a fantasy football guy?
Oh, love it. Love it. We've been doing the same group with dads and kids for about 10 years. We got our draft coming up on Sunday night. And what's the most important thing? I have an excuse to go out and get a bunch of Taco 12s and boneless wings and pretend that that's important.
Have you ever won?
Yeah, I've won a couple times, yeah.
Okay.
And our stakes aren't very high.
Right, okay. Well, if you want to join the league with Mike...
John Hanson.
Yeah, no. they want to reach out to you for anything legal, state, federal, you're charged with a crime or being investigated, what number should people call you?
Yeah, or just to yell at me or to talk about what we discussed. 312-380-6559. And then any complaints about the show, address to John Hanson at johnhanson.com.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for your time, Mike. I appreciate it.